This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When the Space Shuttle Columbia broke up during re-entry last spring, it left a trail of unanswered questions about what went wrong and whether anything might have been done to prevent it. Today, the panel convened to investigate those questions presented 248 pages of answers. The identity of the culprit was no surprise. At a press conference earlier today, Scott Hubbard, the director of NASA's Ames Research Center, wasted little time getting to the cause.
In four simple words, the foam did it.
To be specific, a 2-foot piece of foam insulation that flaked off the main fuel tank and fatally weakened the leading edge of the left wing. What today's report provides is the context behind the series of decisions and non-decisions that allowed this accident to happen, and what needs to happen now if more tragedies are to be prevented. In a few minutes, we'll hear from key members of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board about their findings and the future of the space program, and we want to hear from you. If you have questions about what went wrong and why, and whether this investigation asked the right questions and reached the right conclusions, give us a phone call, or you can send us an email. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. The Columbia Accident Investigation Board released its report at a news conference earlier today here in Washington. Board member Major General John Barry presented a complicated picture of the pressures within NASA that led to the disaster.
NASA had conflicting goals of cost, schedule, and safety, and unfortunately safety lost out in a lot of areas to the mandates of operational requirements. So what we went through in our analysis is trying to figure out how we can fix the culture, and it's not an easy task. In order to do that, you have to do some organizational changes, and clearly we have made some of those recommendations in this report. But the second part of that recipe is leadership, and that is where NASA has to do its role. We can only provide recommendations on some of the changes, but the leadership is clearly key to that.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris was at the news conference. He's with me here in Studio 3A to talk about the results. Always good to have you on the program, Richard.
Thanks, Neil. Good to be here.
As we heard, the report reserves, I guess, its harshest criticism for NASA's culture. What do they mean by that?
Well, culture is a slippery term, but they chose to define it more or less as how people behave when they aren't actually simply following the rules. And some of the harsh words applied in that condition were that NASA's folks were overconfident and bureaucratic. And I think the root cause of this accident, you can sort of see that when you look at what happened with this foam falling off the external tank and hitting the shuttle. It turns out that that was a very common occurrence. It happened at least 80% of the time, and the shuttle was actually not designed to withstand that. And the people who were running the shuttle program essentially got so used to it happening, they decided it's no big deal. And that was nobody went back and said, it's happening all the time, let's really study the effects of it before we say it's no big deal. They just said, well, if it's happened 100 times and nothing bad's happened, we can forget about it. And that was overconfidence in the extreme, as we saw.
And lack of curiosity, in a way.
Yeah, lack of curiosity, also lack of money, because gradually as the space shuttle program progressed, NASA started to think of it as an operational thing, as an airline, essentially, as opposed to a scientific experiment, which ultimately it still is. It's a vehicle in development, even though it's flown more than 100 times. They really don't fully understand it. But they scaled back the research to understand those sorts of things as they went back and scaled back the shuttle's budget throughout the whole shuttle program.
By the time the report itself was released, we'd had extensive reporting about the foam insulation and the various kinds of tests that they ran to see what kind of damage it might have caused. And the initial speculation of a lot of reporters turned out to be accurate, that was the cause of the accident. There was also a lot of talk about a scathing denunciation of NASA's culture. That also turned out to be accurate. That's another cause that the report identified. Is there anything in this report that surprised you?
Nothing out of the blue. And I think the reason for that is that the Columbia Accident Investigation Board has done a very good job of doing everything in as public a manner as they can. So they were careful not to really give us a lot of conclusions, but they had regular press briefings and they tried to really make this as open an investigation as possible, far more open than you would ever see for a plane crash investigation, for example. And so all the facts really had been coming out since the day of the accident. And so it's not too surprising that there aren't too many surprises.
Now, let's talk about the accident itself and the foam panel. The panel conducted a very graphic demonstration last month of the damage that the piece of foam insulation that struck the shuttle's wing during launch could actually do. Today's report gives an even more complete picture of what happened. What are their conclusions?
Indeed. Well, they were, at the beginning of this, we were all sitting around thinking, well, they'll never figure out what's going on with this. And as the investigation progressed, they were saying, well, we'll come up with a probable cause. But actually, in the end of the day, they said, this isn't a probable cause. We're saying this is what happened, and this is what did happen. This chunk of foam, which is part of the external fuel tank, broke off when the shuttle was traveling at like twice the speed of sound. It only traveled 60 feet, but if you can imagine, this 2-pound chunk of foam essentially came to a complete stop once it hit the air and it was no longer being pulled up. So by the time it hit the wing 60 feet below, the wing hit it at 500 miles an hour, and that was a big, big blow to this leading edge of the shuttle wing, which is only a quarter of an inch thick. It's like a ceramic material. It's like made out of a plate, practically. And it was never designed to withstand anything like that. It was never tested under those circumstances at all. So it punched a hole about the size of a dinner plate in the leading edge of the wing. It was invisible to the astronauts on orbit. When you looked out the window, you didn't see anything, so they didn't think anything had gone wrong. And the analysis at the time thought, well, it was just a piece of foam. It couldn't have done anything. They obviously made some huge mistakes in getting back to their some of the cultural problems. They made some huge assumptions that they shouldn't have made, that this was no big deal. So, but actually what it did do was it created a big opening in the leading edge of the wing. And when the shuttle started coming back to Earth at the end of its mission, it comes through to the Earth's atmosphere, and that friction of just coming in through the atmosphere at such an incredible speed generates a huge amount of heat. That heat poured right through that huge hole and melted out the inside of the wing, and wasn't too long over, you know, it was over middle of Texas when the heat became so extreme that the wing, essentially, the left wing of the shuttle essentially fell off, and the rest of the shuttle broke up. And that's the drama, the story that is told now, the technical part of this, it's told in the report in very convincing detail.
There are almost two sets, areas of questions. One, all of the decisions and non-decisions, hey, the foam is no big deal, that happened before the launch, and then the series of decisions that people had to make once the accident had happened and the shuttle was in orbit around the Earth. One big set of decisions about what to do and what to look for, I mean, whether to get imagery to ask the various spy satellite agencies to see if they could take a picture of it.
Indeed, and they went back and forth on that. The report looks at that in agonizing detail because that could have dramatically changed the course of this event if they had followed through. But some lower-level people wanted some pictures. Higher-level people said, nah, why do we want pictures? And made some half-hearted attempts to figure out who was trying to get the pictures. They weren't trying to figure out so much why they wanted the pictures. They wanted to find out who wanted the pictures, which was kind of the wrong question. And again, part of the cultural flaw, the flaw in the way that this was all thought up. And so they never did end up getting the pictures. They had plenty of opportunities to do so. And so they never really knew what had happened. They assumed that they believed in this very shaky analysis that it couldn't have been a problem anyway. They believed in that shaky analysis so much that they just thought, pictures, who needs pictures? And so that never happened.
And indeed, the head of an engineering study group suggested pictures and then felt like he was being intimidated, that he couldn't insist on this question because, well, as I think he told ABC News at one point, the manager of the program was way up there and I'm way down here.
Right. He thought, well, not necessarily he, but a lot of people in the program thought, well, if I thought it was a good idea and somebody else says, no, it's not a very good idea, I'll just let it drop because I don't want to rock the boat.
Here's an email question from Dawn in St. Louis. I've heard much criticism of NASA concerning the decision to bring the shuttle back down. From what I understand, there is no way the crew could have fixed the damage. Did NASA have any other options than to hope for the best?
That is a chapter in the report, as a matter of fact, and there is a fairly far-fetched scenario by which they could have rushed the Space Shuttle Atlantis onto the launch pad and launched it very rapidly before the shuttle ran out of needed supplies like oxygen and water and so on, but it would have been a very high-risk operation in and of itself, and you'd be risking a second vehicle, you'd be risking more lives. NASA clearly would have tried to do something if they'd known that there was a dire problem up there, but it's not clear that they could have had a successful rescue at all.
Let's go to David, and David's on the line with us from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. About 3 years ago, former flight director Gene Kranz was on the Science Friday program, and I had the honor of talking to him, and I specifically talked to him about the so-called smaller, faster, cheaper approach to NASA's programs adopted by former director Golden. And I had a problem with it then, and I have a problem with it now, and I think it's part of what has driven this culture that you've been talking about. Is very highly bureaucratic and has gotten very far away from the NASA that was, say, around 1973, 74, 75, towards the tail end of Apollo, when we still had a program that was directed in large measure by pilots, by the idea of this is about flying. It is flying in space, but the attitude is one of an aircraft commander, and what can we do to make sure that these missions come off as well as they can and also are safe from a flying standpoint. And I think that what happened to Columbia is terribly symptomatic of a departure from that kind of a philosophy. And as long as we have people who are driven not just by cost and this bureaucratic culture, but unfortunately also by that P word, politics, we're going to have a very difficult road to hoe. I think that it seems to me odd that there's no way for a shuttle. I realize these orbit profiles differ for a lot of different mission-oriented reasons, but it seems inexcusable to me that a shuttle should be in orbit with a problem like this if it's found out and not be able to perform some kind of burn to get to the space station.
David, these are all good points, and I want Richard to have a chance to address them.
I'm just kind of venting here, but
I understand.
You understand where I'm coming from.
And I do have to point out the Apollo program was not without its flaws as well.
I understand that as well, but at least it was a pioneering program, but it was also pilot-driven, and the bureaucratic politics. Granted, it was a program that was at a much earlier stage of manned spaceflight.
Right. Well, your comments do touch very much on part of the report, which says they refer to it as editorializing because it's not an official recommendation, but it's their views of spaceflight after having been through all this, which is that they say rather bluntly, there has not been a guiding vision for the U.S. civilian space program for 30 years,
right.
And there is unlikely to be one. And this is a point they make, and they say. One related point was that they should be a development immediately of a next generation space vehicle. Their vision, at any rate, is that it should be a vehicle that will get people to low Earth orbit safely. And the main thing should just be to do that as opposed to the shuttle, which is, you know, was part of has so many different roles. It's supposed to be a truck. It's supposed to be, the politics got all wrapped up in what the space shuttle looks like today. And
correct.
And so they're saying, let's come up with some simple vision. Let's make a simple spacecraft where the focus is on safety and not try to make it be something for everyone.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take more of your calls about the results of the investigation into the Columbia shuttle accident. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. After the break, we hope to be joined by the man who led the inquiry, and that's retired Admiral Harold Gaiman. I'm Neil Conan, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the report released today on the causes of the Columbia shuttle disaster, which claimed the lives of 7 astronauts last spring. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest here in Studio 3A is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. And NASA created the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, or CAIB, only hours after the shuttle's breakup on February 1st. The 13-member board is independent of the space agency. It consists of experts from the military, transportation, and scientific communities. Their report today is the result of a 7-month investigation involving hundreds of interviews and thousands of pages of documents. Leading the panel is retired Admiral Harold Gaiman, who also headed up the investigation into the 2001 attack on the destroyer USS Cole. Admiral Gaiman joins us now from the scene of this morning's news briefing at the National Transportation Safety Board's Conference Center here in Washington. And Admiral, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleased to be here and pleased to have the opportunity to talk about this tragic accident.
Your report says that without improving its culture, NASA risks similar incidents in the future. How do you recommend that they change, and can they make those changes in time before the space shuttle program is set to begin again?
The recommendations say that NASA needs to change its space shuttle program management and its culture. We describe those as two different things. And we do not prescribe that those two changes need to take place prior to the next flight. The board is very strong in its belief that the kinds of changes we're talking about are not cosmetic changes. They are functional changes that need to be made, and they will take some time.
We have an email question from Derek Williams in Oakland, California. He asks, NASA must be under pressure from Congress to produce results or lose funding. Does your report fault the pressure on NASA at all?
Yes. The external pressures that NASA is under, let me say that the pressures that NASA is under are both internal and external. Some of the management schemes that they have put in place are put in place because they chose to, but a lot of the forces acting on NASA are external. That is, they're put on by Congress and the White House to either do things on a certain schedule or do things within a certain cost constraint or something like that. And it will take the cooperation of both the White House and Congress and NASA to turn this around.
Others have also criticized congressional parochialism, if you will. In other words, protection of various NASA agencies in various different states, in Alabama, in Texas, in California. Has that been a difficulty?
It has not been a difficulty. We looked into that to some degree, and we don't find that that it's a impediment any more than the normal political process in a democratic institution.
Getting back to NASA itself, now you do not assign any individual blame in this report, but some people would say that to change the culture, one of the things you have to have is accountability. Should people lose their jobs here?
We do not assess individual responsibility and performance matters in this report, but our report is full of instances of performance cases that we think may be less than sterling. The proper authorities, whether it be the administrator of NASA or the Congress, can easily read through our report and find places where accountability needs to be sorted out. We did not duck the issue. We just didn't judge it, but it's all in there, and it's easy to sort out. The board feels that accountability is one of the pillars of a good organization management scheme, and accountability is going to have to be sorted out by the proper authorities, but not by us.
We're going to take a call with a listener, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
Let's hear now from Oliver, who joins us on the line from Memphis, Tennessee.
I have a two-part question. The first part, do we expect a lower risk for NASA flight missions than we do for military flight missions? And a related question is, it appears that we are scrutinizing the NASA disasters more heavily than we would scrutinize a military disaster. I'll take the answer offline.
Oliver, thanks very much for the question. Admiral Gaiman?
Well, space shuttle flight is much, it's an order of magnitude more risky than any other kind of aviation, including military aviation, and even including military aviation in combat. The numbers, the probability numbers associated with a shuttle flight kind of bounce around depending on who you ask, but they vary along the lines of either 1 in 200 chances of a failure to maybe 1 in 1,000 chances of a failure. But those are very, very much more risky odds than military activity. The two are nowhere comparable. There is no way that you can compare shuttle flights to any kind of aviation activity. The shuttle is much riskier than that. As to the second part of the question, I suspect that because shuttle accidents are so rare and they're so highly visible, that they probably do get more scrutiny than a military plane crash.
Never to say that any seven lives are more important than any other seven lives.
That is correct, and any loss of life is very tragic. But I think that when an airliner crashes, pretty detailed investigation goes on into it, and but I'm not in a position to judge the relative intensity of the various investigations. This one was pretty intense, I can assure you that.
Your report shies away from making any specific recommendations on the future of manned spaceflight. Why is that?
Our report does not shy away from making any... It does shy away from making any specific recommendations, but our report specifically addresses the future of human spaceflight and the shuttle program in the sense that we want this report to be the basis by which a good, earnest, vigorous public policy debate should follow now, and what is it that the United States expects its space program to do for them, and is the United States willing to resource it? We've put in the report the true characterization of the risks, the true characterization of the costs, a true characterization of how these things are managed or mismanaged and what needs to be done to get better. Now the question is, we need to have a public policy debate among the people who make these decisions to see whether or not the United States wants to foot the bill.
Your task is not complete with the conclusion of this report, the presentation of this report. You're going to keep working, right?
That is right. This is the verbiage of the report. All of our findings and recommendations and deliberations are in this volume. But we are going to continue to produce more volumes, which will hold all of the resource material, all the references, all the material that we consulted, such that when the complete four or five volume set is complete, that a student or a researcher in the future would be able to go and not only look at our conclusions and our findings, but also look at the source material that we looked at to come to those conclusions.
One final question, and this is in an email we got from Nicholas Zakari. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. NASA management structure was blamed in part for the groupthink or consensus pressure trap of the 1980s Challenger debacle. Was groupthink at play again? Was dissent among more cautious members of the planning structure in NASA muted by a group desire not to delay the launch?
Yes. We don't characterize it quite that way, but the parallels and similarities between the Challenger launch decision and the Columbia decisions are very similar. We characterize it slightly different than groupthink, but the parallels between the two accidents are close. That leads us to have some uncertainty that the institution can change itself without some outside impetus.
Admiral Gaiman, I know you're extremely busy today, and we thank you for taking your time.
My pleasure, Neil.
Retired Admiral Harold Gaiman headed the Columbia Accident Investigation Board. He joined us from the National Transportation Safety Board's Conference Center here in Washington, D.C. And let's get another call up on the line. And Howard joins us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes, as a follow-up to the issue of the Challenger, this seems awfully reminiscent. There are another seven people dead. What is the possibility that they're going to be criminal charges? What comes to mind is, with this type of thinking in NASA, somebody should be liable for criminally negligent homicide.
Richard, is that something that's mentioned at all?
It's not mentioned in the report. I think you'd have to talk to a lawyer who can explain the vagaries of where and under what circumstances you can sue the U.S. government. But I believe that there are it's not so easy to do.
Well, now I'm not talking about a civil lawsuit. I'm talking about the U.S. Attorney's Office bringing charges for a crime having been committed. negligent homicide.
Well, the report certainly did not go that far. It found people who made errors of judgment, certainly, but I don't think that they didn't characterize anything quite that strongly.
Thanks, Howard. Appreciate the call. When the Columbia Investigation Board originally convened in February, members of Congress complained that it contained too many government and military officials to produce fully independent results. One of the three members added from the scientific community to address those concerns was Douglas Ascherhoff, a physics professor at Stanford University and a Nobel laureate. He joins us now from Stanford's radio studios in Palo Alto, California. And thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You've been quite outspoken with your criticism of NASA, not only their organization before the accident, but also the likelihood that they may not improve in the future, at least in your opinion. What are your concerns?
Well, if you look at what happened after the Rogers Commission report, for a while NASA really seemed to be getting its house in order. But as time went on, the budgets eroded, the number of employees were cut, and they basically relaxed back to the kind of thinking that they'd had that had produced the loss of the Challenger. There have been a myriad of reports between then and now, by the way, and largely they have been ignored.
Well, we asked Admiral Gaiman about that email question about groupthink, and do you think that there were many of the same pressures and many of the same cultures at work?
Well, first of all, let me state that I think we're really referring to the culture within the human spaceflight program at NASA. NASA is a very large organization, and they do a lot of things. There are two robotic missions on the way to Mars now, as we all know. That's a really different organization. Of course, they all meet at the top. Sean O'Keefe is on the hot seat, so to speak. But I think that there are two different cultures within human spaceflight. There are the engineers, and then there are the managers. And I look at those very differently. Certainly, the engineers recognized very quickly the likelihood that the orbiter had sustained substantial damage and wanted to get on-orbit imaging in order to confirm that and go from there. And as you know, in fact, the managers were not listening to them.
In fact, seemed to be at some points dismissive of them.
I have to say that if you read the report, you find out what pressure the managers were under, the schedule, the goal to get Node 2 completed in the International Space Station by February of 2004 was really driving a lot of things at that point. And so all I can imagine is that the managers hoped that there was no damage. But I find it pretty inexcusable that they would have not looked to make sure.
We're speaking with NPR science correspondent Richard Harris and with Douglas Ascherhoff about the report today on the Columbia disaster. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Mr. Ascherhoff, you were added to this panel to improve its independence. Do you feel that the panel was independent? Did it end up asking the right questions?
I think it was independent from the get-go. I mean, let me say that Hal Gaiman is an incredible person. I've really enjoyed serving underneath him. The other members of the panel, many of whom are professional accident investigators, I think I have been led by those guys. They're the people that really knew what was going on. I kibitzed a lot, but I think it was a very thorough and very successful investigation.
Let's go to a caller, and Jim joins us from West Berlin, New Jersey.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm a high school physics and astronomy teacher here in New Jersey, and I just had two quick points. First of all, we discussed in my physics class that this is a 2-pound block of styrofoam, and maybe it's only styrofoam, but a 2-pound block of styrofoam traveling at 500 miles per hour, my physics class calculated it out. That's some substantial kinetic energy involved. How could NASA not have looked at that and said there's a possibility of damage to brittle carbon-carbon ceramic tiles? The other...
Well, why don't we take these questions one at a time,
sure,
Jim?
Sure.
And Mr. Ascherhoff, Dr. Ascherhoff?
Yeah, thank you. I'm afraid that I probably would have forgotten the other question. The quick answer to your question is I don't understand, but clearly the engineers that had discovered the foam strike in the ascent video and film that was obtained recognized right away the possibility. I think the students in your class can calculate that if in fact it's a normal incidence, which wasn't the case, that the impact is several tons, the maximum force.
Correct.
So I don't know. I don't understand it. I think, again, you have to go back. There were, for 20 years, NASA management had lived under the belief that foam could cause no damage.
Richard Harris, I wonder, isn't part of the problem just the word foam? It seems insubstantial.
Well, that is part of it. But it is also true that at the very top of this hour, you played that little bit of tape from Ron Dittamore saying it was traveling at 60 miles an hour. So they had...
Sean O'Keefe, actually.
Yeah. Oh, was that Sean O'Keefe? Mm-hmm. It was a very misleading, and you know, obviously they didn't fully appreciate it. I think the other thing that we saw earlier on in the investigation, perhaps even before Dr. Ashraf joined the committee, was the great focus on the fact that it was going to hit the tiles and what kind of damage was it going to do to the tiles. And there was this belief that since the tiles were so fluffy and they were made of glass, a very lightly packed glass, that if it wasn't going to do really bad damage to the tiles, you didn't even have to think about the leading edge of the wing, which of course was a really bad assumption.
Reinforced carbon-carbon, a different material, and
right,
as it turned out, more vulnerable to this. Jim, quickly, the other part of your question?
The other half, in my astronomy class, we would always discuss the Challenger accident, and it's already been brought up a couple of times. I downloaded the report this morning when it was available on the web, and the chapter 8 title struck me, History as Cause. That really struck me. In looking at it over the past several years, or past 5, 6, 8 years, things that have happened that I have noticed as a layperson that NASA has been doing that just seems to be contributing over and over and over again to that same mentality, as has been mentioned, that safety is... NASA can do everything. The Apollo 11 almost miss on the landing, Apollo 13, these things that they fixed, and everything worked, and that was great. But now you get that mentality of, well, we can do anything, and that led to Challenger and now has led again to Columbia. Seems like an ongoing theme.
Jim, more of a comment than a question, and we're going to have to leave it there because we're running out of time in the segment. But thank you very much for the call. And Douglas Ashraf, we appreciate your time today, too.
Yeah, there's no possibility I can tell you why the velocity was 500 rather than 60 miles an hour, I guess.
Not on this program.
it's really amazing. They knew it took 0.16 seconds. If you say 1/2 AT squared, 60 feet is equal to, I mean, you just solve for A and then multiply by T, and you get 500 miles an hour.
We'll work on the math during the break. Thank you so much for being with us today. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, NPR science correspondent Richard Harris is with us as we discuss the results of the investigation into the loss of the space shuttle Columbia. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. In the wake of the disaster, some question the need for manned spaceflight. With us now from her offices in Houston, Texas, to talk about the value of manned spaceflight is former astronaut Mae Jemison, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. You're very welcome. And I'd just like to start off by talking about human spaceflight, because one of the things that is very interesting about the whole idea of an accident is when something happens, then we recognize the whole idea that exploration is not done without risk to human life. But that doesn't mean that you stop.
Yet some say, you know, this particular mission was, you know, maybe its necessity was a little less than advertised, that the kinds of experiments aboard that space shuttle weren't necessary to send up then. This was not to refuel the International Space Station. This was not to fix the Hubble Space Telescope. That this particular mission may have been more politics than exploration.
Well, I think, remember, when we talk about human exploration, we have to remember that exploration has a number of different forms. It's not just for a particular application. You don't always know, okay, I'm going to fix a Hubble Space Telescope. That's furthering one type of exploration where we move further into the universe and we understand things. But there's a whole idea of maintaining human presence in space. Because as we become used to the idea that we're in space, that we become a spacefaring species, so to speak, then that means that we'll have a next step to move further on, just the way as we moved across continents. You have to actually stay there for a while. You establish a residence. You establish a presence. And then we become more into the habit of knowing what do we need to do to maintain that presence.
You, when you were an astronaut, obviously had an interest in the future of continued human spaceflight. I'll take the correction. And I wonder now, though, there are just three shuttles left. Do you worry about the future of spaceflight?
Well, let me tell you that I have had an interest in human space exploration since I was a child, since I can first remember. And, of course, I didn't lose that when I left. My concern doesn't have to do with the idea of here's one vehicle or another vehicle, but rather that we have a commitment as a society, as a nation, to continue our exploration. Now, that commitment can't run the form of we only have one possible vehicle. We know that throughout time we've gone from the Mercury capsules, Gemini capsules, Apollo capsules. We had Skylab up for a while. We know that other nations have other launch vehicles. So to say that we're tied just to the shuttle design is a misnomer. Yes, part of what's going on now may be a wake-up call that we need to continue coming up with new vehicles. One of the issues that sometimes happens with success is that the shuttle was able to do so much that I think in a lot of people's minds for the past, really, since 1981, we've thought that that's, you know, the only vehicle that we can use.
A new vehicle will end up costing a lot of money. And a lot of the great achievements that you talk about were the result of political goals, get to the moon before the Soviets did. And then there was sort of a, you know, extended momentum from that effort. What's the goal now?
But, you know, here's the thing. Our society is made up of a lot of times scientific goals are political. Anything that people do is political, whether you cloak them as the politics of working against another country or you cloak them as human progress. Those are things that we want to do. So what are the goals? We get to learn more about our planet as we go into space. We get to establish new ways of methods of making materials. If we establish a lunar base, we start to change the idea of who we are, what our place is in the universe. So when you talk about what is the goal, it can't just be, we can't just measure ourselves because we beat someone else there. And in fact, I think when folks look at the 60s and they see space exploration as merely something that had to do with the Soviets, we forget the fact that we could have had that competition somewhere else. We could have chosen to compete to get to the bottom of the ocean, which is still a place that we don't know very much about. It was because I think we have, as humans, this idea that we want to expand where we are. So the goal is continuing that expansion, continuing that idea that we are more than just bound to this planet.
Mae Jemison, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Mae Jemison is the founder of the Jemison Group, a technology company. She was with us from her office in Houston, Texas. And Richard Harris is still with us in the studio here in Washington. And let's get some more questions. And let's go to Sam. And Sam is with us from Rock Springs, Wyoming.
Yeah, Neil, let me tell you that my father was Hartley Soulé, who was assistant director of research for NASA. He retired 3 months before John Glenn flew. He was the project director on the X-1, X-15, and he was an aeronautical engineer. And his principal concern was that the agency was going to succumb to the pressures of politics, money, budgets, and this sort of thing, and that safety was going to be an issue that was way down the road. We talked about this some years ago, and it seems to me like this is the same thing that's happened before. And I think one of the things that really needs to be structured in this thing is safety is first. And that's all I've got as an observation. It's almost 30 years or so, and it's come up again and again and again as one of your people mentioned it. And I don't think you can get away from the necessity.
Yeah, it's interesting that the NASA mantra throughout so many of these hearings and so on in the investigation was one manager after another came forward and said, safety is first. Safety is the sea we swim in, et cetera, et cetera. The idea it was that people thought that they had safety first, but they didn't really recognize that safety was really what it took to do that. I mean, supposedly in NASA, you can pull out a card that says stop everything now, and when you see a problem that's a safety concern. And that works actually very well for occupational safety. They've got a very good record for occupational safety, but it is not. But these cultural changes, very subtle changes since the 70s, have made that more the safety idea more rhetorical than reality.
And it really can't be.
Yeah, well, that's clearly what the Columbia Accident Investigation Board said. They agree with you.
Sam, thanks very much.
All right.
Email question from Bonnie in Mount Airy, Maryland. I was wondering why the damage to the wing was not an issue when the shuttle was leaving the atmosphere.
Ah, good question. I think the answer is that it doesn't heat up as much as it's leaving the atmosphere. In fact, the damage was so subtle that they actually looked to see if they could see any change in its ascent because when they were doing it. But they didn't really see anything in the ascent. But the answer is it only heats up when it's coming back in because it's got all of that energy that it's taken to get it into orbit. Now it has to get rid of coming back in, and it does that in the form of heat by heating up the whole undersurface of the shuttle. So the conditions are not at all comparable.
Earlier this hour, Sean O'Keefe, the NASA administrator, spoke to his staff members about the report that was issued today. And let's listen to an excerpt from what Sean O'Keefe had to say from a news conference earlier this hour.
It's a different NASA today than it was on February the 1st. Our lives are forever changed by this tragic event, to be sure. But nowhere near as much of the lives of the survivors of the Columbia crew. We must be as resolute and as courageous in our efforts as the families have been in working through this horrible tragedy. They have been a source of inspiration every single moment of every day in working through this challenge. How we respond in the days, weeks, and months ahead will matter as much as what we decide to do and whether it will be a lasting change that will withstand the years from now. And indeed, that's precisely what this board and their report will help contribute to us to achieve.
There will be more on this story later today on All Things Considered. We wanted to thank Richard Harris for being with us today here in Studio 3A. Always a pleasure, Richard.
Likewise.
And here are some of the other stories NPR News is working on this afternoon. The Congressional Budget Office is now projecting the federal budget deficit to be in excess of $500 billion next year. NPR's Andrea Seabrook will bring us a report about the politics of red ink. And in Beijing, China, representatives from six countries gather for talks on North Korea's nuclear program. NPR's Rob Gifford has a report on those meetings, which begin tomorrow, and again, details later on All Things Considered. Right now, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.